The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning, how are you? You're very welcome to the show. No real agreement across the papers on what's important today, so I suppose either everything's important or nothing's important. The Business Post are leading with state plans new winter booster campaign as Pfizer supplies hit record levels. But sure, it's going to be the winter by the time we get the initial campaign done anyway, by the sounds of things and according to what Colm Henry was telling us yesterday. So it looks like we'll be flipping straight away then into boosters. And they're saying that the mass vaccination centres will be wound down, and obviously we're going to have to come up with a more sustainable way of doing it. So it'll be GPs, chemists, etc., if we're going to be doing that regularly. They also have Jim Sheridan on the front page talking about his Sky documentary on the murder of Sophie Toscan Duplantier, and we'll be talking to Jim in just a little while. The Sunday Times is leading with cross-border trade rockets thanks to Brexit. So there's a boom in trade between the Republic and Northern Ireland and vice versa. Also pointing out within that story that, right, one in five of all EU border checks in the whole of Europe at the moment are happening on that border, on the Irish Sea, as it were. They also have half of all mica houses must be torn down. And across the papers today, there's an interview with Dara O'Brien in the Sunday Independent. It sounds like there could be way more to this than we think. He's saying on the in an interview there with Roddy Edwards inside in the Sunday Independent, they have it on the front page, there could be issues in four more counties. That is, I'd say, the status of a blank cheque at the moment. 1.5 billion it seems to be hovering at now. Sunday Independent leading with another housing story. House prices to hit Celtic Tiger level, experts warn, and the central bank have been warning that there'll be significant house price growth in the near to medium term too. And of course, Leo Varadkar was accused by a lot of people of being tone deaf during the week when he pointed out that in the course of a discussion on housing, that house prices weren't at Celtic Tiger levels. I think some people think that there's a new bubble happening, but that this bubble in a funny way is being funded by the state buying houses and stuff. The Mail, another housing story, 2025 before housing targets can be met. So this is a secret internal document they saw. And I think that's the target of 33,000. But now Leo Varadkar is saying they're going to build 40,000 a year. Sunday World leading with this guy, James Daly, who got a tax defaulter notice during the week he was carried in the papers, 11.7 million. And there was mystification in the area that this guy does. He's a car dealer. He doesn't even own a garage and everything. So he claims he's baffled as well. He owed 4.6 million in taxes. Then to add it to that was 2.5 million in interest and 4.7 million in penalties. So he'll have to sell a lot of cars from his non-existent garage before he pays that off. The Mirror, Christy Dignam is down to his last 300 quid. He's been overlooked, I think, three times now for grants to get the ban back on the road. He says inside that he was thinking of ringing the local Chinese takeaway to see if they wanted a delivery driver. He doesn't have the money for his next mortgage payment, he says. And The Sun on Sunday is a story about Dave Mahan, who was convicted of manslaughter of his partner's son, and about his imminent release. Now, our panel are here and they're raring to go. Fionnán Sheehan is Ireland editor of the Irish Independent. Professor Clina Ní Chealaigh is a consultant in general medicine and infectious diseases at St. James's Hospital. And Dominic Kemp is a chef, author and a restaurateur, businesswoman, and a renaissance woman all around. The perfect panellist indeed. And I'm raring to go as well. I have my Dublin-based South candidates list in case of an emergency. It's behind glass there. I smashed the glass if I need to pull it out, if anyone accidentally says anyone's name. Before we get into the kind of broader issues of things, there's a story in the Mail today, and you will have seen it on broadcast news and stuff as well, that last night, yesterday evening, I think around tea time on Stephen's Green, there seems to have been a kind of a pitch battle between gangs of youths, organised fighting apparently. yesterday evening. It seems gangs of teens are going into town with these set up fights and stuff. It was going on in Temple Bar as well yesterday evening, they say here. So a young man was stabbed in the leg during what they're calling a mass brawl. And then we saw that kind of that extraordinary kung fu footage from South William Street, which was all over the place during the week. And Fionnuala Sheehan, you were in town, I hasten to add, not an organised gang to go in that fight, but you were around Stephen's Green yesterday
evening. If I wanted that, I'd go back down to Liberty Square in Thurles on a Saturday night. But I was in town anyway, and I went on a Dr. Tony O'Hulahan disapproving tour of Stephen's Green and the environs. And look, perfectly nice atmosphere down around Merrion Row, Hugo's Restaurant with Gina Murphy back open, very cosmopolitan, European feel about the area down there. You come up around Stephen's Green and down by the lake, it's all very laid back. You go over by the playground, it's kind of very hippy-dippy kind of feel, teenagers just hanging out. And then you go over by the bandstand, which is over towards the Department of Foreign Affairs Ivy House side, and it's kind of a bit more oxygen festival type thing. You've a lot of teenagers there, a lot of them just there hanging out having fun, a lot of them fairly drunk even at that early hour of the evening. And when you see kind of large groups of young fellas hanging out and they're looking suspiciously around themselves, you're kind of going, well, they're either here to flirt or fight. And some of these guys seem to be there for the fight. So I think I was about half an hour later, something kicked off then around about up at the entrance into Stephen's Green.
And so you were there, obviously, on the family side of things, right?
Yeah.
Is there an atmosphere in town? I know you say that there are obviously pockets where it feels great and everything. You go into certain pockets. Is there an atmosphere where you think, well, I'll get out of here? And
There's certainly parts of it are perfectly pleasant and perfectly nice. And it's a nice, I remember that summer in Dublin, kind of feel about it. And then there's other parts that you wouldn't necessarily recommend that people go wandering about without keeping their wits about them. The now infamous South William Street, which everybody now knows about, has got two Gardaí, basically, seem to me to be permanently posted in the middle of it, just standing there.
And does that seem like enough visibility, basically?
Well, there was no fighting breaking out while I was there. I mean, again, that street was back, very busy, a lot of outdoor dining there. But if it actually takes putting two guards there, just to keep a lid on the situation, is not a great reflection.
Like, Dominic, I remember town in the depths of lockdown, and I think all the city centres felt really kind of, in a way, slightly forbidding and spooky and kind of no man's landy, and a different type of people seem to have taken over. Are people managing to reclaim the streets in your experience? You obviously have businesses in town and that.
Yeah.
Or is there still that tension there?
I think it's, it's unfortunate that there was such a kind of staggered approach in some ways, even though it's sensible, I suppose, from a public health point of view. I guess when you're serving takeaway pints and there aren't necessary facilities for people to use toilets and so on, people are all just congregating in kind of concentrated areas. Before those pubs opened up to sell takeaway drinks, you definitely felt it was a bit eerie walking through town. Then retail opened up, there was definitely a kind of calm that descended. But I think once indoor dining opens up and we see a little bit more normality, I think that whole feeling where you get a kind of tension in town will dissipate somewhat. But it's entirely understandable that people, you know, are anxious to have fun. The weather's, you know, shining. Yeah. People have a few drinks. I've been in town on a few of those afternoons and you can definitely feel it kicking off. But in general, the mood has been very convivial and good-natured. And it's just unfortunate that you see a small amount of people causing quite a lot of harm. But it they are small in numbers, I think.
Yeah. So it's hopefully a distinct kind of just a public order issue as against a societal issue at this stage.
Yeah, and I think it'll continue to dissipate as more things open up.
Yeah. You do hear a lot of people saying they go in for a few pints, or they have a few pints maybe after work now recently, and then they say at a particular point they get out of town because you can just feel the atmosphere
starting to change. Yeah.
Which is a shame. Cliona, have you thoughts on this?
Well, just it's probably worth talking to the young people. I don't know. I'm an old one. So but around what they want and what they need for this summer, especially if they're not being allowed to travel. Lots of the things, gigs, you know, nightclubs, all those places where you go to flirt and have a good time are shut. So what can we offer them instead, I think? Because, you know, those kind of fights is just pent up energy, you know, and we need to use it somewhere else.
Yeah, you always have the good word for everyone, in fairness to you, Cliona. So look, in terms of that broader picture, I suppose the thing that's facing us now, really, the main item on our plates is the Delta variant, is it, Cliona?
Yeah, I think so. It's the Delta variant and I suppose the ongoing situation in which lots of the world haven't been vaccinated. So actually, it looks like, you know, that awful storm cloud with the Delta variant and vaccines not working at all wasn't the case with this one. So, you know, that's great. And we had a policy of sticking to vaccine schedules, not like the UK where they were like, let's just get one dose into everyone. We were always going for two doses on time. So we're not in the worst case scenario at all, but it's a good warning that we need to up our game.
So you're thinking that the Delta variant is not the clear and present danger, but that it's a warning of another one that could
be. Absolutely, because the nightmare one is one where the vaccines don't work at all.
Now, I'm looking at the Financial Times, I think it was this morning, it was on their website. I don't think it was in the paper yesterday. Delta now dominant in Portugal, 96% of cases, taking off in Germany, France and Spain, 20% in Italy, 16% in Belgium. People saying it could halt the progress of the EU, that basically the rest of Europe is where the UK was a few weeks ago. You're nodding with a sad face on. So is it inevitable?
It's inevitable. And I think, you know, we're trying to slow it, which makes total sense because this is a really critical period, right? There's a difference between now and 2 weeks down the line and a month down the line in terms of how many people have been vaccinated. So trying to slow it is a really good idea. But it's going to come and it's going to take over the same way that the Kent variant, you know, the Alpha strain did that. Delta is going to do that as well. Delaying it is a good idea while we're at this point. But it will happen.
And in terms of I heard who did I hear? I heard Kingston Mills talking about the fact that the border with the north is obviously, well, it's fully porous, that people, you know, Derry is the hotspot now. People have holiday homes in Donegal and all that. I mean, is it inevitable unless we seal that border or something? It's inevitable it's going to drift down here.
It's inevitable that it's going to drift down. And what we can affect is the speed, you know, when that drift is going to happen and how quickly it can spread once it gets here. So buying ourselves a bit of time is a good idea. But obviously we can't seal the border with Northern Ireland. That's just not possible.
Yeah, it's not politically swallowable, is it? Is it, Fionnán?
Well, not on a number of reasons. For a number of reasons, be the amount of people going over and back, be the citizenship issue, and you can add in Brexit and the tensions around the Northern Protocol as an additional reason why, if you start imposing further restrictions upon people coming from Northern Ireland south, more so than you have on people south of the border, well, then it's very easy for Brexiteers to say, aha. So you can put in border restrictions when it suits you.
Yeah. So the question we're left with then is that we have, I think, Micheál Martin's still gamely kind of saying that we are on track for July. From what you'd be hearing, is there any worry that this is going to start interfering with the opening up plan?
Well, that, I think there's still that caution there that they don't really want to overstretch themselves. They're probably going to miss the vaccination target, the 80% one for June, and that was anticipated because of supply issues. But it looks like you'll get back on track then by July, August, and into September when you'll have a more wider reopening on the workplace front. There still seems to be that view that you can't overextend yourself because you don't know what's going to happen, such as the Delta variant or a variation therein. In fact, if you go out to the Middle East at the moment, you're seeing that there's a completely different virus that seems to have nothing to do with COVID that is now striking kids and they're becoming quite
really,
sick
yeah.
there. Yeah, so that's been reported out of the UAE at the moment, that it's just a flu and it looks like it's just a flu that is circulating predominantly amongst children and younger people. So these things kind of can flare up.
Of course, this opens up this question of, Cliona, are we going to freak out about every flu or virus now that happens? Like, now that we have this new playbook where none of us touch each other and we all wear masks and everything else, will it be easier the next time? Will some of this stay with us?
So I'm hoping that the increased hand hygiene stays, because I think we had plenty to improve on there, having had kids and having had them bring home every gastrointestinal virus in the entire world home to my house. I'm glad that some of that will stay. I think wearing masks when you're sick and you have a cold, like they do in Asia, is probably a polite thing to do, and maybe now will be socially acceptable. Yeah, but on the other hand, we need to, you know, we're social beings. We need to be able to hang out together and do all of those things. I mean, ventilation is another one. Any investment that we've made in ventilation, that's great. That'll prevent, you know, help us with other viruses as well.
So. Yeah. Have you had to invest in ventilation, Dominique, for premises, or how does that work?
Well, we've been closed for most of the time. Yeah. So it's, and certainly in some of the locations that we're in, we're part of a larger, so in departments, tours and everything, obviously there's big moves to improve ventilation. But, you know, I think one thing that we're not talking about enough in terms of businesses is antigen testing. And certainly when you look at the recommendations of the Ferguson report, it was start immediately, and that is back in April. And we still haven't done it. And certainly the during the committee meeting last week, it's still unclear why there's such resistance to it. And, you know, from my understanding, you know, viruses mutate. That's what they do. This is going to be an ongoing problem. We're not going to eliminate COVID in the next few years. You know, the vaccines will probably be replaced by boosters. So why aren't we using antigen?
And what would you like to see it used for example?
Well, where it's brilliant is tracking down people who are infectious. And, you know, there seems to be a lot of distraction in terms of arguing between PCR and antigen, which is better. But they're two different things. And, you know, we've based a lot of policies on case numbers, which PCR have picked up, and arguably maybe they picked up too many cases when people aren't infectious. So really, you know, say you're getting on a flight, or say you are going to a wedding or an event, wouldn't you like to know if you're infectious? And I think that's really a critical piece of information. And certainly there are large calls for it now.
Yeah.
But it's not being embraced. And I don't understand why you commission a report. Ferguson report came out. It's very clear, you know, page 6 and page 43, start immediately. That's back in April.
Well, we seem to be unsure if it was actually considered by NPHET. So just before I go back to the others in this, in your specific situation, so would you like to see a situation whereby people coming into the restaurant either show you that they've been vaccinated, or else that you have the comfort of knowing, some comfort of knowing that they've taken an antigen test before they came out, for example?
I think you need to empower people to make those decisions themselves, because right now, if we don't start preparing for winter and the inevitable spikes that will happen, and you start educating and encouraging people, I think, you know, we're all very much committed to trying to make sure that we protect each other and our communities. And actually, by getting people when they're going to crowded, when they're going to a party, or maybe they're going to visit people in a nursing home, it's serial testing. It's not just doing a one-off antigen test. It's maybe doing two or three a week in advance of a situation where you're going to be with a number of people for prolonged periods in close contact. That's where the risks are. And when we look at where all the cases have come from, the majority have been hospitals, nursing homes, direct provision, and households. You know, they haven't been hospitality and they haven't been restaurants. That's not where the problem is.
Yeah, but I think we do know that gatherings like weddings and stuff like that have been massive super spreader events, and there have been a lot of case studies of that kind of thing. I think where a lot of people gather
indoors is a problem. It's usually where there's a lot of shouting and singing and so on. But in general, you're talking about very well-controlled environments. And hospitality, as I said, when you look at where the case numbers originated from, hospitality wasn't the demon.
Okay. Cliona, you picked out, Daniel Murray has a good piece in the Business Post about the moral hazard at the heart of NPHET's reluctance to use rapid antigen testing. In a way, it seems like people are having two different conversations, where on one hand, the people in favour of it are saying, look, we're not suggesting it replaces it. We're suggesting it's an additional belt and braces thing that might catch cases. And then on the other hand, it seems like the CMO is saying that that those people are saying it be used to replace PCR testing, and they're not. And maybe where the two cross over is in aviation, where people do seem to be kind of saying it should replace PCR. So it's complicated, isn't it?
It's really complicated, and I have loads of thoughts on it.
Okay.
I think the first thing to note about the Ferguson report was that of the six authors, two didn't sign off on it. So the two public health doctors that were on that group of six, if you look in the report, there's an asterisk beside their name. So there's been dissent on that.
But four did sign
four
off
did.
On it.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah, exactly. But it's important to note that there was dissent even within that expert group. I think my experience in medicine is that if there's huge debate over whether to do A or whether to do B, it means that there may not be a huge difference involved between A and B. So nobody's arguing, should we vaccinate? Nobody's arguing, you know, at times of peak, do we need to stop congregating? Those are things that we know work. And antigen testing is less, the benefit is less obvious. And I suppose it is exactly like you said. So, and as Dominique said, if it's being used serially to try and pick up people that you wouldn't have otherwise picked up, so it's not replacing anything, it's a belt and braces, it's an add-on, yeah. Like in universities where, you know, you're not going to catch everybody who has COVID with it, but you might catch some that otherwise would have spread. Then it makes sense. And where I would have caveats is around aviation, for example. So, you know, it's not a very sensitive test. It's totally not going to pick up everybody with COVID. So it wouldn't make
Does it pick up everyone who's infectious?
Absolutely not. No.
Because that is one thing that people seem to say.
But it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't. Okay. Now, it's like anything. The more often you do something, the more likely you are to pick it up. So exactly as Dominique said, if you're doing it every day, you might miss it on Monday, but you might, you know, Tuesday's test might pick it up. But if you're using it as a one-off to replace a PCR is much better at picking up everybody. And even PCR doesn't pick up everybody, but it'll get most.
But we're also talking about PCR that is potentially picking up cases where people are not infectious and you're making those people isolate really for no reason. There's huge societal harms for basically lockdown, as we know, but also
and a whole family like going into isolation.
You know, so you can't compare the two tests in terms of this is better than they both do different things, and surely that's the point. We want to pick up infectious cases because PCR is, again, according to the Ferguson report, is unsuitable for widespread testing.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we're not talking about...
But that's what we've been using. We've been using PCR.
No, we've been using PCR for... We've essentially been using PCR for people who are symptomatic and in settings like nursing homes or meat factory plants where you really want to be very careful that you're not missing any infections. We haven't been using PCR, for example, before concerts or in universities or in those kind of settings where you're going to want to be doing
it frequently. Yeah, but we're using nothing.
We're using nothing. Exactly. Yeah.
So are we better off using something?
So... Are we better off than using something? Probably. Are we better off using it and then opening up based on it? That's, I think, the question that Tony Houlihan and the public health doctors would have, that if bringing in antigen testing is going to change how people behave, is going to make people feel safe in a setting in which they're not safe, is, you know, what are the harms of that? And that's impossible to know in advance.
Yeah, but this moral hazard thing and so on, it's extremely frustrating because, again, people are incredibly good. We're so committed to this. We have sacrificed so much. And again, the Ferguson report talks about educating and encouraging people. And we want to do the right thing.
I think Luke O'Neill has a very good, simple line on this, which is that if you get a positive, go away and isolate and get a PCR. If you get a negative, act like you never took a test. It doesn't empower you to do anything, really. But it's just, you know...
Exactly.
But the problem is, lots of people, you know, when you get a negative test, are you really going to act as if you didn't get a negative test and think, well, I might still be positive? You know, that's the human nature that comes into the equation. And that's the one that's very difficult to answer.
Yeah. And we can't wipe out human
nature.
But
it's a little bit patronising to assume that people are just going to go, woohoo, I have a negative test, I'm going to go crazy. And, you know, people just aren't that. We're in such a state of fear and anxiety and worry and concern. People want to continue to do the right thing. And we're not just going to blow up everything that's been achieved. But I think adding the antigen test to the arsenal, I think is an incredibly beneficial thing. They've done it in Canada. They're talking about Team Canada, Luke O'Neill's article, and just showing how successful it is.
And how many infectious people they caught. Like,
exactly. Yeah, and it's like, if we could do that, where will we be in the winter? But let's start now.
Okay, well, I'll come back to you in the winter in a second because I don't think any of us are thinking about the winter. Fionnán, just you had picked out a couple of the antigen pieces as well, Luke O'Neill as well. Where are you on this?
It does just seem that the political debate just swings so rapidly that 2 months ago it was lock the country down, anybody who comes into it whatsoever, lock them up for 2 weeks, don't let them out, they might infect the rest of us. Now it's basically, all right, yeah, we better get aviation open as fast as we can, so let's use antigen testing. I suppose that's the nature of politics. You move on rapidly from one view to the next as the prevailing wind changes.
But is there a tension now that there mightn't have been before? I think the politicians had manners put on them there by Christmas, right?
Yeah.
And it was yes or no, sir, Tony, how high do we jump? Has a tension re-emerged, say, about around the antigen testing thing between public health and politicians? Because the politicians are less than convincing, it has to be said, when they're out saying, oh yes, we agree with about the antigen testing, but we think it should be used loads.
Yeah, I suppose the politicians are caught in that bind of, you know, you're right at the time, but you're wrong kind of a month later. Where it's not easier, but when you're following directly the science and you're saying, look, we're warning you that something might happen, and then the politicians are kind of going, well, yeah, but it mightn't happen. So if a situation emerges in a month time that aviation is then the cause of a spike because it got opened up more and antigen testing was used, the public health officials can come back and say, well, we told you and you went ahead anyway.
So caution always wins here, doesn't it?
Caution,
there is no impetus for anyone to take a risk with moving things on.
Well, you look at the football yesterday and you see 61,000 people at a match in Budapest versus our attitude here. Where we're putting a couple of hundred or what, well, 2,000 people at a game in Croke Park. So I'm not for any reason saying let's follow the Hungarian model.
A Derry match though.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did 1,200 people come down from Derry, the Delta hotspot of this island?
Presumably it had to be divided evenly between the two counties. But you are now, because the debate is progressing, because on the one hand you have Dr. Tony Holland saying, yeah, look, amongst vaccinated people, we believe that COVID is effectively being eliminated, which is basically the argument to keep on vaccinating everybody else to remain cautious, that people are now moving ahead and saying, well, right, if you're telling us on the one hand that it's being eliminated, and yet on the other hand, you're saying, well, hold on and be cautious over here. So there's obviously going to be that tension there, because politicians are going to come under pressure from people to say, open up a lot faster. Having said that, you look at the Irish Times poll on Friday, are we opening up fast enough or should we go faster? Public divided pretty much 50-50. People saying no, one half saying keep it steady there now, and the other half saying we're not opening up fast enough.
Yeah. Dominic, I presume you're in the half who's saying we're not. I think those halves are probably people who work in the public sector, people who aren't being economically impacted, who think, well, you know, let's do the cautious thing because there's no downside to it. Presumably what is caution to those people, Dominic, is can look reckless to you in terms of the damage being done.
Completely. And it does feel that public health has just been so focused on COVID that we've forgotten that one person every hour dies of cancer in this country. You know, it's like we've just lost all sight of the sort of holistic view of health. And that does cause me great concern, because lockdown has been a lever that's been pulled so often now. And going forward, is it going to become just the only option when case numbers rise? We can't eliminate this immediately and directly in the future, but I think we need to take a different approach to how we deal with it in terms of how we isolate people, how we pick up infectious cases, how we deal with it, how the hospitals deal with it.
Are you confident, for example, that when your businesses reopen fully, that they will stay open?
No, I'm no, really not. You're not. I'm not, because again, unless we're serious about actually taking all the measures that we can and, you know, adding things like antigen into the mix, I don't see how we can. I think lockdown, we just got so used to suddenly lockdown is what's going to happen. The lever is pulled and that's it. And it does cause concern.
How can we sit here, right? Like okay, you and I at least, and you, Fionnuala, right?
Are getting a salary.
All of us are fine, right? To an extent, right? How can you sit here and look at someone whose business has been closed for the guts of 18 months now and who has no confidence that her business will stay open in the next year or so either? Like,
so I think I have a few thoughts on that. And I think, you know, the countries that went for a stronger approach and really tried to eliminate were able to keep their businesses open. You know, so I think this kind of toing and froing has been what's been so devastating from what I can see for many industries. So, you know, we need to, I think, I would argue we need to aim for elimination and go hard. You know, let's get the vaccines out. Let's get the world vaccinated. Let's get on top of things. Let's aim to have everything reopened safely, permanently soon.
Okay, getting the world vaccinated is going to take years, isn't it?
Well, no, not if we stop hoarding our toys, you know. There's loads of factories that can manufacture vaccines that aren't being used.
Yes,
150 was what I heard that could do Moderna tomorrow if Moderna
really?
Shared the
okay
paint.
I thought there was an issue with A, factories to do it, and B, raw materials. So no. That even if they gave away the IP and the
well
whatever.
Why do you think they wouldn't be, do you think they'd be worried about giving away the IP if nobody was going to use the IP?
Well, I think it's the precedent they're worried about,
isn't
it?
Yeah, but like this is an emergency, global emergency.
Now, can I ask you about something else? Because have you spoken to anyone in Australia recently?
Yes, I have.
Now, I'm starting to think this is a long game here, right? Mm-hmm. And they were doing great. And now anyone you talk to down there will tell you that, well, the narrative developing here is that Australia was very good at closing down, but not so good at opening up, right? Nobody wants to take vaccinations, apparently, because their attitude seems to be, well, I'm not going to get COVID because there's no COVID. And if I take the AstraZeneca, which there's a lot of down there, I gather, there's a minuscule chance I get. So there's nobody, very few people opting to be vaccinated. Apparently, most people in Australia don't feel the need to travel outside Australia anyway. But business people, Irish people, all these other people are thinking this is like stuck in a nightmare. Now there's no
get
COVID,
me out of here.
And if there's one case, we get locked down again.
Their restaurants
situation?
Have been open, so you know, if Domini was working in Australia, if her businesses were in Australia, she wouldn't have been shut for most of the last year. You know, they have been open for business, internal business. I think the other thing that I'd like to comment on what Domini said was about the cancers. So we have a massive problem because of what we've been through in the past year. You know, we're seeing loads of people present really late with cancer. A lot of the people that died from COVID were cancer patients. You know, so it's not an either or. You know, COVID affects everything. And absolutely, can we use this as a time, as I don't always agree with Leo, but actually for once I did agree with him. Can we use this as a time to think, okay, how are we going to build back up? And how do we support people in the hospitality industry? You know, how do we share? I've had a secure income. My income hasn't changed. How should I be sharing with Domini when she, because of the industry that she works in, that she has been affected?
So you would agree with paying more taxes?
Absolutely.
To give more,
I would happily pay more taxes
to keep
businesses open and to ensure
them,
that we can get through this together.
Yeah. Fionnuala, Leo Varadkar, interesting kind of pivot he's done from, I suppose, remember the leadership campaign in Fine Gael, and Simon Coveney was the Just Society, Gareth Fitzgeraldian wing of the party and all this, and Leo still kind of regarded slightly as Tory boy at that stage. And then last night, we find Leo Varadkar, the last great socialist, the Just Society, money for this, money for that. It's about health service, low-paid workers, all this. Is this the most audacious political pivot we have seen since Bertie Ahern, the last great socialist?
Yeah, I feel sorry for Richard Boyd Barrett waking up this morning looking in his wardrobe and finding all his clothes have been stolen by Leo Varadkar. There's only blue shirts hanging up there. Instead, he'd be wandering down the pier in Dunleary in his dressing gown today. But it effectively, when you look back only 18 months ago, and Fine Gael are saying, no, you got to keep the brakes on here now. We can't get carried away. They can argue that, COVID has changed. The attitude at an EU level has been very much spend your way through COVID, as opposed to 10 years ago when it was put the austerity clamps on now and solve the issue that's at the heart of the euro. So
did you get the feeling that whole we're all Keynesians now is kind of running out of steam slightly, and people are starting to panic a bit elsewhere, aren't we? But we're doubling down.
There was an argument that it was the right, it's definitely the right thing to do when you look at the package of measures that, that Pascal Dunne came up with 15 months ago, particularly across one weekend where they were, he was effectively sitting on the couch with the chairman of the revenue commissioners and the head of his department. They came up with things like the PUP and supports for businesses. Now, that was transformative in terms of a state approach to a crisis. Last night, I was looking at that party political broadcast, and I was wondering, why is Pascal Dunahoo not in this? Is he is he chained away in his house in Fisborough? Yeah, yeah. Because suddenly it's abandoning all of the principles that he was setting out. I presumably, of Radker's argument will be, well, look, times have changed, and therefore I've changed with him.
Yeah,
I'd be interested
times
to see
have changed in that Sinn Féin are the single greatest threat facing us now.
There is a by-election coming up. We tried the hardline approach going into the last election and got kicked around for doing it, so therefore we're going to have to change tack. It'll be interesting to see the maths behind his theory here, because he hasn't really set out when he's saying, well, economic growth will fund this. To what degree, when you're saying the economy is going to take off like a rocket, I mean, are we heading to Mars here or what? I mean, just the amount of spending that he is now outlining will inevitably result in greater borrowing, because he's also saying, I don't want to increase income taxes at the same time. When you look across the tax package in terms of what you can alter there, you can look at something like corporation tax. They obviously don't want to do that because it diminishes the competition of the economy. You then look at the other areas that bring in large amounts of money around USC income tax, and Leo is saying, no, we're not going to touch that either. So he's going to have to explain where exactly is the money coming from.
Okay, and I'm sure there is a good explanation. I wondered, is he looking at Boris Johnson, who has developed this kind of third way of being the Labour Party in the north of England and being the Tories in the southeast, and is he thinking that this levelling up notion where you can be all things to all men actually works? But then I think the Tories got a wallop in that by-election and are suddenly thinking we need to get back to Tory values. So,
well, it worked for Bertie Ahern across three general elections, where, you know, he was returned and returned again on the basis that he was saying, look, if we keep the economy pumping, then the money comes in and we get to spend that on public services. And meanwhile, we'll let the private sector do as it sees fit, because as long as they're pumping money back in, that's fine.
Yeah. OK. All right. Fionnán Sheehan, Cliath Ní Chaillig and Dominic Kemper staying with us. Let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Dominic Kemp, Professor Cliath Ní Chaillig and Fionnán Sheehan. And obviously, even by the dramatic standards of Northern Ireland, it was a dramatic week up there. So the newly elected leader of the DUP, Edwin Poots, nominated Paul Given as the North's first minister. Sinn Féin did a deal with Westminster about the Irish Language Act, and it all fell apart. And Edwin Poots, just a few weeks in, was skewered by his own party members. Tommy Gorman, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Tommy, I hate to call anyone a former anyone, so you're not a former Northern Ireland editor for RT. Would I say, are you Tommy Gorman of the Currency now? Would that be how I'd introduce you?
I'm Tommy Gorman, journalist, I hope.
Okay, very good.
Writing for the Currency and following events with interest.
Excellent.
And on your programme this morning, Brendan.
Okay, and Tommy, you know, we were told about Poots when people worried about the creationism and everything. Oh, don't worry, Poots is a pragmatist. But has it turned out he was too pragmatic even for his own party?
I'd say it goes deeper than that. I think he and those people who were very close to him got a very, very rough lesson in the relentless attritional nature of politics. Like, if politics south of the border are a goldfish bowl, it's even more intense up north, much more dangerous. And I think while Edwin Poots and Paul Given and the likes of Ian Paisley Jr., who supported him, while they'll feel a sense of humiliation and hurt in these days, I think before too long they'll realise that they were thoroughly unsuited to the kind of challenges that Arlene Foster put up with and struggled with, that Peter Robinson put up with and struggled with. And I thought when he took over that it could take up to 6 months before the moment of truth came. I didn't think it would come as fast, but come it did. And in many respects, they were architects of their own misfortune.
Yeah, go on. To explain about them being architects of their own misfortune.
Well, they obviously, like, events show that they did not have any thought through strategy. They put all their energy, and circumstances helped them, all their energy went into taking out Arlene Foster. But they hadn't worked out what comes next. Mm. And if you just say, think of the ironies. Arlene Foster had wanted to bring in the Irish language provisions that had been promised as part of the New Decade, New Approach arrangement. But she had been prevented by doing so by her own party, with people like Edwin Poots and Paul Given and others prominent in opposing it. So within days of them taking over, here they were doing this side deal with the British government to actually bring in something they had prevented Arlene Foster from triggering. Yes. And the worst part of it was they had said to their supporters, we're going to be different, we're going to be tougher, we're going to deliver, we're the pragmatists, we're able. But they had entered into an arrangement with the British government where Sinn Féin was gaining and they were getting nothing in return. And like, if you think of the irony of that equation, like, Sinn Féin doesn't take its seats in Westminster. Here it went, it did this side deal with the British government. It doesn't have huge bargaining power or heft with the British government. And on the other side of the equation, you had the DUP with friends among the Tory Brexiteers, unionists like the Conservative Party. And here they were having to accept this Irish language provision, and they were getting diddly squat in return. So that level of humiliation for the DUP meant that the people who supported Edwin Poots suddenly realised, what have we got ourselves in for here? And they left him. They drifted away like snow. And suddenly he found that he had no support base, and that's why he had to go.
And Tommy, it must really feed into, you know, this unionist feeling that their identity is under threat here, and that the government in the Republic obviously tends to support the nationalist agenda a bit more. America, they don't have friends there either. And they were the one place they thought they had friends, they've now been done over by them as well. It must leave them feeling very sore and isolated and insecure as unionists, does it?
Well, you probably don't get a chance to tune into it too often because you lead a busy life. But if you have the chance some morning, just turn on the Stephen Nolan programme between 9 o'clock and 10:30, Monday to Friday on BBC Radio Ulster, because he sets the tone. He sets the pulses racing. And you'll feel the level of his intensity and pressure that's building up within the Northern Ireland system from listening to that programme. And you're quite right that in the year of the centenary of Northern Ireland, that unionism is under this terrible pressure, that this reckoning that has been going on in the DUP since Ian Paisley and Peter Robinson brought them from a party of protest to a party of power, that has been going on as well. What has really compounded all the difficulties is Brexit. The poisoned fruit that the DUP consumed and sold, and that they hadn't thought through the consequences. One other reality, Brendan, and this is so important to state, it's now election season in Northern Ireland. If they wait until May, there will be an assembly election. It could come beforehand. And in election season, what you have to do is you have to appeal to as many of your own supporters as you can in order to get the strongest possible vote. Because without a mandate, you're dead in the water. So election season has begun. And in some respects, you can see a hint of election season south of the border as well, with, say, the by-election that's coming up in Dublin. And if you listen to some of Leo Varadkar's, comments in recent days, you can see that he's looking to the election as well. But in Northern Ireland, the election is a more immediate thing. It's coming in May at the latest.
Okay, and Sinn Féin really kind of pulling this fast one on the DUP, probably doing them no harm at all. They seem quite pleased with themselves under the surface, yeah?
Yeah, it's a sugar hit for them, Brendan. It's good for them in the immediate term, but you just watch the consequences, because I'll make some predictions to you now.
Okay.
That DUP leadership, Geoffrey Donaldson is a shoo-in, provided he puts his name forward. He's 58, and in some respects, it's now or never. It's tricky in a way because he's going to have to come back from Westminster. So nominations are open. Nominations will close at midday on Tuesday. So you could see by as early as midday on Tuesday, Geoffrey Donaldson confirmed as the new DUP leader. One possible rival, outside chance, is Sammy Wilson, an MP, was reluctant to go from the Assembly to Westminster, always felt that he deserved a shot at the leadership, didn't get it. But I don't think in these circumstances Sammy Wilson will go up against Geoffrey Donaldson. I think he'll leave him a free run. So if that happens, as early as midday Tuesday, Geoffrey Donaldson being the sole candidate, he will be the declared new leader of the Ulster, of the Democratic Unionist Party. But then the DUP has got a choice to make. They're going to go after the British government and Brandon Lewis in particular and say, OK, you did your side deal with the Shinners. Now we're looking for our part of that bargain. And they can put pressure on him, probably in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol and other matters.
OK.
They will leave Paul Given in place as the First Minister until they feel they really have to ratchet up the pressure. Because once they take out Paul Given, they have 7 days in which to nominate a successor and to get Sinn Féin support for it, to get Michelle O'Neill in as Deputy First Minister. If that doesn't happen within the 7 days, they automatically trigger a new election. So it's going to get very intense from Tuesday on, but just watch to see the DUP put pressure on the British government to extract concessions.
Okay. Tommy, before you go, I was taken with two things in the papers today. Joe Brawley made the point that Northern Ireland is a peaceful modern society where the people are miles ahead of the politicians. And Maria Cahill, who you could argue is coming from a very different perspective, is kind of making the point that people now just want the politicians to deliver. They want them to deliver on stuff like waiting lists and everything else. Is there an impatience among, you know, people who want to get on with their lives in Northern Ireland that their politics consists and their discourse consists of the kind of carry on that was going on this week?
Joe is right and Maria is right on one level, entirely right. On another level, it doesn't take an awful lot to get pulses racing in Northern Ireland, to get people onto the streets. There are people who don't believe in power sharing. You say, for instance, look at the likes of Jim Allister and the strong role he had. He's a very powerful voice. He's very good at finding fault with things. You have the marching season coming up as well. And we always have to remind ourselves, Brendan, that the model that's in place at Stormont is utterly unique. It's a mandatory coalition. It's there for a reason. That's the structure that was required to get society away from a place where killing was the reaction of one side when it felt threatened. It has moved away from that. It hasn't moved into stable politics of government and opposition. It's on that journey, but it's not yet there. And while we can look at things in a reasonable way from down south, we also have to take into account that it remains a fragile, a unique place, and matters there have been compounded and changed by Brexit.
Okay, Tommy Gorman, thanks a lot. And we'll be talking to you again, no doubt. And we'll watch to see if your predictions about the protocol come true. Thank you, Tommy Gorman. And let's take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel's still here. Fionnuala Sheehan, Professor Cliona Ní Cailleagan, Dominic Kemp. And a lot across the papers again this Sunday about housing, the Mail 2025 before the housing targets can be met. And that story in the front of the Sunday Indo about house prices to hit Celtic Tiger levels. Before we get into the broader issues. Cliona, you're trying to buy a house at the moment.
Yes, so we bought our house in 2007. It's a two-bed in Inchicore and there are four of us living in it and there's one toilet and the fights over who gets to go into the bathroom first are unmanageable at this point. So we need a bigger house, but it's really reminiscent of the bubble times. Very little on offer, prices going, you know, way above what the initial price is. Now, obviously, we're lucky enough that we now have a stake in the market. You know, when we sell our house, it'll be worth more than it would be at a lower price time. But it's just, it's very, very difficult, you know, and the prices are just mad. The same way that they were in the boom, it's exactly, it feels like 2007.
Does it? Yeah. And have you
tried to put a bid on anything, or have you?
No, we've looked at a few, and then, you know, the bids have just gone up, and we've, you know, I suppose we haven't found our dream, so we'd love to stay in Inchicore where we are. There's very few. I'd love four bedrooms, so when the grandparents come over from Finland to visit my husband's Finnish, that they'd have a room of their own to stay in. So very, very difficult.
Yeah, yeah. This is not going away for the government, is it, Fionnán? And they, like, announcements of new plans by the week at this stage. Like, but there's a sense that they're failing to make an impact with people, to punch through with people. People aren't getting that feeling that, yeah, they have this in hand.
No, they kind of just want delivery. I mean, again, last night we were getting further figures from Leo Varadkar about ramping up housing production, but, you know, with a party in government for 10 years, it does slightly ring hollow. People just want results at this point. It feeds in as well, I think, to the issue around MICA and the slow response there towards, oh, well, we need to set up another review to look at it and so on and so forth. And people are just going, okay, this has gone on for several years now. This is not a surprise that this has come on the agenda, and yet you're telling us we haven't set up another review.
But I suppose, in fairness, they had a programme in place, and what people are saying is that programme we have in place isn't good enough. So they were dealing with the issue.
Yes, but if you're dealing with something inadequately in the first place, then it is going to come back and bite you. Likewise, on the renting issue, 18 months ago, we were told, look, you really need to be careful here what you do with rents. There's constitutional property rights and landlords can take you to court and so on and so forth. The pandemic hits and you get rent freeze and eviction freezes put in place. Now we're back to the argument again about, well, we really can't freeze rents because, and we need to look at it further and so on. So that impatience is going on. It's kind of captured there.
Yeah, I think, in fairness, I heard Simon McCoveney telling Justin McCarthy yesterday that, like, he was actually the first person to bring in anything like a rent freeze, and they were, and that they're looking again at the issues that have arisen out of that with a view to tightening it up in some way.
They're looking again at a replacement to the rent pressure zones system, which is due to run out later on this year. There is an issue arising this summer where, as the economy returns to normal, as colleges return and people return back to urban areas, that there will be a glut of demand again for limited enough supply. And at the same time, the rent pressure zones legislation will mean that you can actually have double rent increases this summer. Now, Dara O'Brien is saying that he's looking at that and he's going to come up with something in the next month. Again, it's kind of like, oh yeah, we got caught out there. We didn't really realise that was going to happen. But it's not anticipated. It's coming down the track. You look at the sentiment is kind of captured there, story in the Sunday Independent from Niamh Horan about people's views on the property market. 4 out of 5 worried about the market in terms of where prices are going and where supply isn't coming. 3 out of 4 people like Cliona basically saying we're having to look beyond the location that we'd like to live in, where we are rooted.
People always did. People always did, in fairness.
And 9 out of 10, though, saying they expect that the government should do more. So the blame is firmly, the finger of blame is firmly being pointed at the government's direction.
The government are spending billions on this every year. And, you know, there is a big social housing project, big affordable housing projects. All of that is ongoing. We should just say that.
You've got to acknowledge that. But at the same time, you kind of have to turn around and go, measures that are being put in place now, were they adequately in place over the course of the last decade? Now, you have to look back a decade ago, the housing market was completely bust. The issue that we were looking at the time was negative equity for people. We were looking at evictions and we were looking at empty properties around the country in the form of ghost estates. Those issues were, largely speaking, resolved and mediation measures were put in place.
Okay.
There's now a new crisis. It just doesn't look like the new crisis has been dealt with the same ferocity a couple of years ago as the previous crisis.
Dominie, I just want to bring you in briefly before we finish up. I was talking to somebody who owns businesses similar to yours in town, and he said to me that basically none of the staff who work for him can afford to live anywhere near where they work, that you can't get a good chef in Dublin because they can't afford to live in Dublin.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have returned home to their countries, and a lot of people have just decided enough. A lot of chefs have gone into construction. You know, it's been a real real change. And I think also it's probably been a year where people say, well, actually, if I'm going to make a change, I'm going to do it now. Yeah. So there's probably been a lot of soul searching and saying, I want to get into a different industry.
Yeah. OK. All right. Dominic Kemp, thank you very much. Thanks, Fionnán Sheehan and Professor Cliona Ní Chealaigh.